begins to shed in the process known as menstruation. The name change of these groups of cells is the basis for the name change of the different part of the menstrual cycle. The first part of the cycle is called the follicular phase. The second part is called the luteal stage. Now, the next row shows the buildup of the uterine lining and then the decline of the uterine lining in response to these hormones. Of most interest to us are the numbers on the very bottom, which indicates that the cycle is 28 days long and that ovulation will take place on day 14. All medical illustrations, in fact, depict this cycle as lasting 28 days, even though only approximately 30% of the female population has this particular cycle length. In real life, any cycle between days 21 and 35 or 42, depending which book you read, is considered normal. If the luteal phase consists of 14 days, which is what it says in most textbooks, then ovulation can take place, in fact, from day 7 to day 28 or 35 across the spectrum of normally cycling women. If one allows for more variability in the luteal phase, saying it can be 12 to 16 days long, as a few texts will admit, then it can even vary from 5 to 30 days and be normal. With the addition of the fact that the ovum only lives from 12 to 36 hours, once again, depending which textbook you consult, and the conception only takes place with a viable egg, we conclude our medical background and we'll begin our halachic background. The halachic cycle consists of the following steps. First, there's the onset of the nidah status, defined as uterine bleeding not caused by injury. Then the woman must assure that all bleeding has ceased by an internal self-examination known as hafsek tahara. Then for 7 days she assures through additional internal self-exams known about bedikot that the bleeding has not restarted. I skipped over a step because before the Shiva Nikiyam can happen, she has to have a minimum of 5 days. Okay, we learn all this from a number of psukim in the Torah, most important one being V'isha ki tiyeh zava, dam yeh zova b'tzara, shivat yamim tiyeh b'nidata. And on this, the Chachamim made a bunch of drashot that I'll get to the bottom line in the interest of time, that the only things that count to make a woman nida is uterine bleeding. If we know we are not dealing with uterine bleeding, if we know there's another cause, she's not nida. On a Torah level, it has to be bleeding from 5 very specific shades. And she becomes nida only when the bleeding is still within her body, even if it has not exited, which is the reason for the internal self-examinations. Now, just to show you how specific the 5 colors were on a Torah level, they were black, they were red, the color of a wound, red, the color of a crocus flower, red, the color of earth, but not any earth, specifically the earth from the Valley of Bekerem, and like diluted wine, and not any wine, but specifically 2/3 water to Shiryoni wine. Okay? Now, the expertise of recognizing these specific shades has been lost over the generations, and therefore today on the practical level, we use pretty much any shade of red. Now, what makes the difference between nida on a Torah level and nida on a rabbinic level is a concept known as hargasha, what I call a halachically relevant sensation. Now, it is not clear exactly what the sensation is. There are a number of different explanations given in the sources, one of which is that her whole body shakes. The other one is she feels her uterus open. The other is that she feels liquid flowing. Now, many of the post-menstrual women around here are kind of wondering, huh? Okay, I don't remember my whole body shaking or anything like that. Don't worry, you're normal. Okay? These sensations seem to be relatively rare. I've yet to meet number one. I've met one woman who claims she knows number two. A fair amount who actually do experience number three, though not necessarily at the onset of the menses, sometimes in the middle. On a rabbinic level, nida also happens in the absence of hargasha, in the absence of these halachically relevant sensations. However, the rabbinic decree has a number of caveats, which we will discuss later on. Now, once again, on a Torah level, don't practice this at home. All right? A woman becomes nidah on the day that of the onset, and then she's nidah for 7 days, whether she bleeds for 1 day or she bleeds for 7 days till right before sunset. There is another concept that is known as a zavah. This is one from another pasuk in Vayikra, and it has to do if a woman bleeds longer than she expected or at a time that is unexpected, and this woman has to wait 7 additional days. 7 days that are often called the Shiva Nikiyim, 7 blood-free days. Now, if she saw at an unusual time, and it was only 1 additional day, she'd have to tack on 1 additional day. If she saw 2 days, she'd have to tack on 2 additional days. If she saw 3 days, then she fits into the category of a Zavah Gedolah who has to wait for 7 additional days. So now, we're back to a very understandable question. Why nowadays, the way we practice Hilchot Nida nowadays, do all women count 7 days? And the reason is that if you start by thinking that a tahor, discharge, makes you nida, okay, remember we've lost the tradition about exactly which shade of red is going to make a woman nida, and if we choose the wrong one and say you are nida earlier, and we would go on the Torah method of just counting 7 days, you could actually, on the Torah level, be going to the nikvah much too early. Another possibility is, as far as it being an unexpected time of the month, you might go to the mikveh at the wrong time of the month, once again, on a Torah level. Now, to help avoid this problem, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi made a decree where he said, okay, we're going to add on 6 extra days, because 6 extra days will cover all the possibilities. If she really was only Zava 1 day, so she really only had to add 1 day, and we just added 6, so we covered it. And if she's Zava 2 days, she bled for 2 days, we'll end on 6 days. We've covered all possibilities. If she bleeds for 3 days, we'll end on 7. The women of Israel apparently felt that this was a little bit too confusing to decide when to do 6 and when to do 7, and therefore decided that for any kind of bleeding, they would end on 7 days. I showed you the progression because there's a lot of times there's a tendency of women to say, oh, why were women so stupid that they added on 7 additional days? They didn't. At the most, they added on 1. Not 7. Those are there because of a halachic need. Now, as far as that 5-day minimum, the 5-day minimum is there because of a different halachic issue, and that is that if a woman would expel semen after having relations during her Shiva Nikiyim, that day of the Shiva Nikiyim wouldn't count. It's not like she's nidah, she has to start all over again, but that particular day would not count. And she would have to, if she did not realize that she had, in fact, had this expulsion, she might also could go to the mikveh too early. And to prevent this possibility, they added a minimum. The first minimum that was added, that shows up in the Shulchan Aruch, is actually 4 days, because from a halachic point of view, the sperm is only viable for 72 hours. 72 hours spread over 4 Hebrew days, depending when they would start. And therefore, if you put in a 4-day minimum, you've pretty much covered all the possibilities. The Ramah brings the Ashkenazi practice of adding 1 more day just in case they happen to be having relations in that ambiguous time between sunset and nightfall. So the Ashkenazi custom is a 5-day minimum. Certain Sfaradim hold a 4-day custom. And there then was a series of additional gzeirot that we keep this minimum even if no relations took place. We took this even the couples are in completely different locations, so we're sure that no relations took place. But these are additional gzeirot that, first of all, not all Sephardic communities hold them. And second of all, it's important to point out their gzeirot because a principle that we sometimes use is that perhaps in a time of great need, the gzeirah was not intended to fall in the first place. And therefore, we can play around with this minimum. So to summarize, the earliest time that an Ashkenazi woman can go to the mikveh if she has a relatively short cycle, is 12 days, and the earliest immersion is the night following 11 days for some svarim. And now we get back to our picture of ovulation. Okay, in that classic 14-28-day cycle, she's going to ovulate on day number 14. However, if she doesn't have a 28-day cycle, and she has a shorter cycle, and she's ovulating 14 days between the next cycle, she could possibly be ovulating before the 12-day minimum. And that's how we come up with the situation of possible halachic infertility. This graph comes from an article from Dr. Yaakov Levy back in 1970. So the problem was known for a while. However, there have been halacha responsa dealing with these kinds of situations pretty much over the last century. Though if you notice, for most of them, when they were published, 1954, 1962, they predate much of what we know today about hormonal manipulation. So the possibility of changing the cycle wasn't really an option at the time these tshuvot were published. You'll also notice that almost all of them are dealing with ways of shortening the 5 days, of dealing with the 5 day cycle. The one, two exceptions are Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote an article about how to possibly circumvent her being nida in the first place, which was on a practical level probably a little bit difficult to actually do. And Rav Kook, who does mention the possibility of going back to keeping nida on a Torah level, but he's the only other person who mentions that. Everybody else talks about shortening the 5 day minimum. And they deal with it because it was a series of, they wrote, it was a series of rabbinic decrees as opposed to the 7 day moving to a rabbinic level, which was to avoid a real Torah prohibition. Over the last about 30 years or so, we began to actually have medical ways of manipulating the menstrual cycle. Estrogen has been used also since the 1970s. However, this article in 1970 was published in Hebrew in HaRefuah, so I have a feeling that most of the reproductive community was unaware of this particular article worldwide. And it's really in the 1990s and the 2000s that you have in the general English fertility lecture using estrogen as ways to push off the time that a woman is menstruating, either by using estrogen alone, the kind of estrogen that is used in women for the symptoms of menopause, or actually using birth control pills for a short amount of time at the beginning of the cycle. It tends to delay ovulation. It could delay it till past mikvahs. Another approach has been the use of clomiphene. This was mentioned by Spiroff in his 1991 version of his textbook. Interestingly enough, his more recent versions don't mention it at all. And another approach was that by Rav Yosef Green back in the 1980s, where he suggested using artificial insemination at the time a woman is nida as a possible solution to dealing with what he called religious infertility. Now, debate on this topic really began, I think it's already now about 4 years ago, when a religious gynecologist by the name of Dr. Daniel Rosnack was interviewed in a newspaper called Hatzofeh, and he raised 4 points. First of all, he said that one quarter of his fertility patients are suffering from halachic infertility. It's very common. We must deal with it. Second of all, he claimed that the fact that all women keep Sheva Nikiim is only a minhag, and therefore it can be changed. I hope from my introduction you realize that's not such a simple thing, what he said. He raised the halachic issue, the ethical issue, a general medical ethics. He said, how can we possibly be giving medicine to women to be treating something that is only a religious concern? Religion should actually deal with it. And after all, these medications are dangerous, and we have a mandate to prevent danger, therefore we shouldn't be using them. And his conclusion was we should simply get rid of the Sheva Nikiim. One of those points, I actually agree with him, and that is that there are dangers to fertility medicines, and they really should be dealt with respect. Okay? A number of articles have brought up the issue in terms of increased risks of cancer, both breast cancer and uterine cancer, and they should not be prescribed by the local pharmacy on the recommendation only of the Rav. I hate to say it, but that does go on. However, though, I think before we get to that, we have other questions that need to be asked. And my questions are, is this condition, is this 25% of women who are supposedly suffering from this being diagnosed correctly? And I want to answer no. I say this for the following reasons. Number one, as Yoetzer Halacha, I answer questions on a website, and we have had, when this slide was made, it was 6,500. There are now 10,000 questions that have come in to the website. We've dealt with about 100 or so questions of halachic infertility. Not one woman had ever gone to a Rav to find out if she was really Nida. And in almost all the cases, it was clear that her lack of understanding of the intricacies of Hilchot Nida that I tried to give somewhat of a background meant that she probably wasn't. Okay? Furthermore, only 3 women had actually tested if they ovulated or not. What does it matter? Can't we just subtract 12 to 14? And the answer is no. Okay? This is a study that was published in 1977 by Dr. Wallman, who loved nothing better than counting numbers. This was pre-computers, guys. He hand-collected over 30 years, thousands of cycles of women, and hand-entered them and calculated them and made this chart. And the striking thing about this chart is even women with short cycles sometimes can be ovulating late. Just to take an example, if you look at the women who have less than 19-day cycles, 30% of them were ovulating after day 15. The luteal phase is apparently a lot more flexible than it's given credit to in many medical textbooks. Measuring ovulation is a relatively simple thing to do, especially now that there are home kits of urinary LH predictors. Their price has gone down over the last number of years, and a woman should actually test if and when she's ovulating before deciding that she's ovulating before she goes to the mikveh. There are other ways of measuring as well, such as ultrasound, serum progesterone levels, basal body temperature, but the urinary LH prediction could be done in the privacy of her own house. The other question is Nida being diagnosed correctly. So maybe, fine, the woman isn't going and asking the Rav, but when she goes to the doctor, doesn't he find out if she's really Nida before he decides that she has halachic infertility? We did a study where we gave out so far 40 questionnaires to different rabbis with scenarios, different doctors with scenarios of women that might come to them with the issue of halachic infertility. Not a single physician had spoken to a Rav. They all take as a given that if the woman comes and says, this is when I have to go to the mikveh, that she knows what she's talking about. And as I said, from my experience in dealing with Yoetzer Halacha, that's very, very, very often not the case. I would propose then, first of all, that we make sure that halachic that our diagnosis is correct, both medically and halachically. And second of all, before we think of medical intervention, we think about halachic intervention. I said that most of the time that when women are nida nowadays, they're nida on a rabbinic level, and that rabbinic decree included caveats. The caveats include that in order for a stain to make a woman nida, it has to be of a certain minimum size, bigger than the size of either a U.S. or Canadian penny, more or less. The location on which it's found has to be a location that is able to assume ritual impurity. Plastic doesn't count. According to many authorities, synthetic materials don't count. The color of the surface, if it's not white, it does not make her nida. And therefore, an intervention that often can help is wearing colored underwear. I don't know of any medical risks to wearing colored underwear. Other than one time a woman said, maybe she's allergic to the dye. But even so, it's much less than the risks that are involved in taking hormones. And there has to be a lack of another explanation. In other words, if it's possible that the bleeding came from something else, that the stain is not uterine bleeding, we can halachically perhaps decide she's not Nida as well. Okay, so I'm going for a halachic intervention first policy. Make sure that women are really nida as long as she thinks by asking about the bedikot. The women themselves should ask. They should not assume that they are nida when they're not. In these cases where a woman is suffering from halachic infertility, using lenient traditions as far as which color make her nida or not, using all those caveats dealing with stains that I talk about, artificial insemination might be a solution in some cases, and therefore, in most cases, we don't need to get rid of the Shiva Nikiyah. As far as the overall ethical question, in terms of can we be doing a medical intervention to deal with somebody's idiosyncratic religious needs, I think the answer is yes. First of all, we have a number of examples within general medical ethics where it is felt to be ethical to use medicine for non-medical reasons. Right? The classic example is cosmetic surgery, whole session on that on Sunday, and it's generally felt to be ethical, you know. Second of all, we have examples of hormones being used for non-medical reasons, and the classic example, especially in pediatrics, has to do now with the treatment of short stature. Okay, there has been some discussion about it. Some people feel a little uncomfortable about it, especially if short stature is no longer just for children who are growth hormone deficient, but even ones who just for genetic reasons are not going to reach a certain minimum height. And this is becoming pretty well accepted by most pediatric endocrinologists. And the last argument is that religion should not be less than lifestyle. Right? And with the American emphasis of autonomy, we let people a lot of times do things because it's their lifestyle, it's their cultural background. And they don't think that religion has to be less than one's cultural background. So in summary on this debate, I certainly think we should be thinking twice before we use the medicine. When we do use the medicine, it's probably not quite as risky as Dr. Rosenack would leave us to believe. And that the idea that we're using hormonal intervention for religious reasons can be ethically justified. Thank you.